Good evening. This is KBOO 19.7 FM, and you're listening to Bread and Roses, our weekly women's news and public affairs program. This KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation and members and a grant from, in other words, Women's and Books and Resources, serving you from its new location at 8 Northeast Killingsworth at Williams. In other words, it's our local non-profit feminist bookstore and resource center offering community space, gifts, tools for the revolution, women's writings, and much more. 503-232-6003 or inotherwords.org. Good evening. My name is Gabi, and I'm very pleased to have with me in the studio tonight Sonia Shah, who is an author, writer, editor, who has edited and written for many different medias. You've edited for Nuclear Times, for South End Press, written in Ms. Magazine, Sojourner, The Nation, The Progressive. Good evening. How are you?
Thanks for having me.
Would you like to say anything else about yourself to introduce yourself to our listeners?
Oh, I'm sure it'll just come out in our conversation.
Okay. And Sonia Shah will be in Portland tonight and tomorrow, so if you want to grab a pencil or something, we will announce in a little while where you can catch her tonight reading from a book and tomorrow speaking at a conference. Sonia Shah, one of the first books that you edited, it was in 1907, was a book entitled Dragon Ladies, Asian American Feminists Breathe Fire. And I don't know, I wonder if there still is a little bit of the perception out there that feminism doesn't necessarily mix with Asian women. Do you want to describe that book a little bit?
Yeah, that book grew out of a different book, actually, which was on Asian American politics more generally. And the person who was editing that book at that time, and this was 1995 or so, couldn't find anybody to write a chapter on women. And I had just been hired as part of the collective at South End Press as one of the editors there. And I said, well, I'll write it, you know. Mm-hmm. And so I started just doing research and, like, talking to lots of women activists. And, you know, I just put this chapter together. And as I was doing it, I realized that there just wasn't anything out there on this topic at all. There had been a couple books. Making Waves was sort of the classic in the field at that time. But it was really quite literary. It wasn't political. It wasn't really looking at feminism per se. So it just seemed like this was this sort of huge chasm in the literature that, you know, that we need to put something together. And I had been part of several different South Asian women's groups, so had friends who were very enthusiastic about it. And over the course of about a year and a half, put the anthology together, and it really took off, which was great. Unfortunately, you know, as that was put together in 1997, here we are nearly 10 years later, and there hasn't really been sort of an updating of those things. I mean, there's been lots of other anthologies that have come out, but I just, you know, it's a little frustrating to see not, you know, that it hasn't really spawned a whole other kind of venue of literature. But, you know, I'm glad it's out there, and, you know, maybe one day I'll be able to update it myself.
Mm. And was this book mostly about Asian American women or Asian women globally?
It was Asian American women specifically, because what we were trying to do at that time is to look at a specifically Asian American perspective on women's issues. So, you know, there had been a lot of literature and talk around Black feminism and Latina feminism, and of course sort of mainstream feminism, which was usually taken to be more white feminism, but there hadn't been anything that really was looking at Asian women in America and our various issues. And I think one of the things that came out of that book, I mean, now 10 years on, is that, you know, it's questionable whether there is that and whether that really does exist, because there's so much diversity within Asian American community. And, you know, the fact that we're sort of all put together as Asian Americans is also somewhat of a construct to fit us into various categories. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I mean, you know, Indians and Pakistani women, obviously we have lots of things in common, but there's lots of differences too. There's tons of difference between, say, a Japanese American woman and a Pakistani American woman or whatever. So, you know, we have similarities, but I think it's sort of a strategic coalition at the time.
Mm-hmm. And I do know that in India there is a very strong woman's movement on different issues. Do you believe that any of that translates to the United States?
Well, I don't know if it translates because I think the issues are so different. But of course, it's a huge source of inspiration because I think all of us, as at least for me, as an Indian American woman, I feel a lot of connection to women in India. You know, of course, women in India have been my family members and my relatives and my ancestors and all the rest of it. So I mean, I feel a deep connection to that country and a deep responsibility towards it as an American, really, mm-hmm. you know. So yeah, I think the issues are totally different, but obviously huge amounts of inspiration. And the symbolism really helps a lot, too, helps us sort of find our way here when we feel kind of lost. So we can go back to Kali or, you know, other... The women's groups are coming up in India and sort of feel inspired by that.
I think even that we don't hear very much about, and I think there probably would be a lot to learn actually from, I don't know, some of these movements. So then in 2004, I believe, you wrote Crude, The Story of Oil, and I believe that's part of what you will be talking about tomorrow at the conference. What was that book about?
That was, I had started writing for political magazines around 2000 or so, and had moved to Australia in 2001 and was living near the Great Barrier Reef on the northeastern coast of Australia. And they had found a potential oil field under the Great Barrier Reef, which was sort of a, you know, just it was an interesting story. Like, what would happen if actually you drilled, you know, if there was pressure to drill at the Great Barrier Reef, you know, what would that mean? So I was writing a magazine story about it, and I had actually come back to New York to talk to editors about maybe putting a book together on a different topic, which was on drug development in third world countries. But ended up talking about this magazine article, and it just turned, you know, and the editors said, oh, you know, you got to write a book about this because it was sort of the right time, you know, it was right pre-invasion of Iraq and people were talking about this. And I had just read a book. A book had just come out saying that, you know, oil is about to peak. And, you know, this was before it really kind of burst into the national conversation, this, you know, this whole concept of peak oil. So yeah, I took a couple years off and, just started to learn about petroleum geology, and I went to London and talked to lots of oil people, you know, top executives as well as oil workers and stuff. And so the book is sort of a natural history of this commodity, sort of trying to explain where did it come from and how did we get to this spot in where we use 3 gallons each every day, you know, as Americans. And what does that mean for our future? So that's what the book tries to do.
And I believe you outline a possible different paths for the possible future regarding to oil based on that history. Can you elaborate a little bit what those paths?
Well, I think the transitions that we're going to have to make are going to either they're going to come to us no matter what we do. So, you know, we can plan for it or we can not plan for it. Either way, it's coming because, you know, we have the known oil fields of the world depleting at a rate of about 3 to 5% every year. We're finding about 1 new barrel of oil for every 6 barrels we consume. And meanwhile, demand is growing by 2% a year. So you can just see, you know, if you plot this on a graph, essentially what you see is a cross. And like, when those two lines cross, that's, you know, there's going to be some problems. And I think we're actually probably right near that point now. So, prices are very volatile. They're only going up. You know, there's going to be scarcity soon. We've lived in a world of sort of oil abundance for a long time, the last 100 years in this country, more, you know, since 1859, the first oil well drilled in Pennsylvania in this country. We've lived with cheap oil, abundant oil, cheap energy, and it's really driven our whole economy and our whole way of living so that we've been able to consume all kinds of other natural resources to, you know, a much higher degree than we would have before, like even, you know, nuclear power and getting, uranium, mining uranium. Well, that requires oily machines full of fossil fuels to move that amount of earth, the things we have to do for mining and everything. So, you know, and the way we've been able to sprawl out has been really, you know, about our oil abundance and using cheap oil. So that's all going to change. And, you know, we can either look at that coming and say, look, let's put into place some reasonable conservation programs now. Let's start to try to power down our economy a little bit. Or, you know, we can just let it come at us. And I think that's sort of the direction we're going in right now. We see more and more resource conflict, resource wars, wars in oil lands. We see the malignant spawn of these petrostates, you know, Osama bin Laden and Saddam Hussein striking back at us. And now we need to fight back. We need to conquer this, you know, all this new power play we have to do in the Middle East now, or feel we have to do if we want to continue with our quote-unquote way of life. That's all part of it. And so it's really about putting the whole picture together and seeing that our huge consumption of oil really requires that now. That is the cost of continuing to do business as usual. And, you know, we have to ask ourselves, well, you know, is that worth it?
So I'm speaking with Sonia Shah, and this particular book is called Crude, The Story of Oil. Sonia Shah will appear at a conference that is tomorrow organized by the Oregon Physicians for Social Responsibility, and she will be the keynote speaker, I believe, at 10 o'clock in the morning, and then she will be at a panel at 11:30. And I'll give you the details of this conference later in the show. It's at Portland State, and we actually, in the second part of this show, we will have somebody from Physicians for Social Responsibility speaking about that conference. Then after the book on oil, you went on to write a book called Body Hunters, Testing New Drugs on the World's Poorest Patients. And I believe the book just came out.
That's right. It just came out last month.
And this is the book you will be reading from tonight at Powell's at 7:30, I believe. What is this book about?
This book actually started in around 2000 when I was writing magazine stories about the drug industry and just various issues in drug development and the kinds of medicines we were developing and what it meant and that kind of thing. And a lot of the sources I had been speaking to in doing those articles had mentioned to me this trend that drug companies were taking clinical trials that they could no longer conduct in the United States for whatever reason and sort of exporting them to developing countries. And, you know, these people didn't know, you know, they sort of were seeing this happening, suspecting something was going on with it, but, you know, didn't really know what exactly the situation was. So I started, and it seemed like a really interesting story to me, so I started writing magazine articles about it. In the course of writing magazine articles, realized that, you know, to sort of step beyond just reporting on scandals. I mean, you could always find like a few scandals here and there and sort of write stories on each scandal as you go on. But to really look at the trend over time, you need to sort of move beyond just the periodic scandal kind of reporting, you know, and actually look at some trials, watch them unfold over time, and see how that illustrates the trend, you know, and what does that trend mean, and what are the ramifications for people's health, for our ethics, for health inequities, and things like that. So that's what I did. I took a few years and, you know, kind of did a lot of research with the clinical research industry here, the people who do the trials here, the drug companies here who are exporting the trials abroad. And then I went to South Africa and India and did a lot of reporting there, talking to clinicians and ethicists and activists and regulators and people involved in actually doing the trials. So the book tries to sort of describe the trend and also try to look at what the implications are.
And this may sound like a silly question, but why would the companies go abroad to do the trials?
No, it's not a silly question. I think it's a really good question because there's just been a huge expansion of this business of doing experiments on people. You know, the business of clinical trials has really grown by leaps and bounds. And today, like an average drug requires about 4,000 patients in clinical trials. And to get that number of patients in a clinical trial, you actually have to get 100,000 people to call in and come in for initial screenings because so many people drop out. So even with doing that, 8 out of 10 trials in the United States fail to meet their recruitment deadlines. So, you know, they're just not getting enough people calling in and coming in and staying in the trials because, you know, Americans have so many drugs available to them. The average American takes about 10 prescriptions a year. But only 1 in 20 is willing to be part of a clinical trial. So, you know, you can see that, and those two things are not unrelated. You know, the more drugs we have that are proven effective, the less willing we become to actually stick our neck out on some experimental drug. But on the other hand, the drug industry makes a lot of money selling more and more drugs. We always want the new drug after it gets approved, right? You know, so So there's this real need to find test subjects, and one way to fulfill that is to go places where those, that relationship between the amount of drugs people have and their willingness to be in trials is reversed. So places where there's not a lot of access to medicines, and so there's much more willingness to be part of clinical trials. And so essentially over the 90s, that's what's happened. This year, some of the big drug companies, GlaxoSmithKline, Wyeth, Merck, some of the other ones have said they're going to be doing half or more of their clinical trials for new drugs outside of the major markets, so outside of the U.S., Western Europe, and Japan.
And if drugs are tested in the United States, there's a process of overseeing this and regulating it. Does any of this apply if they go abroad?
Yeah, in the U.S., before you start a clinical trial, you have to submit your plans to the FDA if it's, you know, for a drug trial, and they have to show the FDA what they've done in the lab, and they have to show them the animal tests, and they have to give them the plan of what they want to do in the trial on humans. And the FDA has a chance to review all that and ensure that research subjects' rights and safety are protected. If it's an experiment outside of the United States, the FDA does not require any of that prior review. So they essentially just say, look, if you're going to do an experiment outside of our borders, just please obey the local rules and please obey the Declaration of Helsinki, which is sort of an ethical international research ethics document. And then you come back to us, give us the data, we'll look at it, and you know, and if the everyone's dotted on the, you know, signed on the dotted line, then we'll use that data. So the FDA doesn't have any sort of ongoing review. They have the power to do it. They could, in fact, go and inspect these foreign sites. They could require that drug makers alert them before they go overseas, but in fact they don't. So what happens is wherever the drug companies go and set up these trials, all they have to do is obey the local rules. And in a lot of these countries, there's very weak regulatory infrastructure and very few laws to protect research subjects, and very little sort of ethical infrastructure for, you know, ensuring that people take patient rights seriously, people take research subjects' rights seriously. So it's essentially just sort of a catch-as-catch-can, and I think, in fact, what ends up happening is a lot of our research ethics codes are violated and a lot of people's rights are violated.
And can you give us an example for a situation where this process just went horribly wrong?
Well, for example, in my book I look at specific case studies in a lot of detail, but, just as a general thing, for example, one of the ethical cornerstones of research in this internationally is this idea of informed voluntary consent, that the people who are in the trial should know what they're getting into and should be choosing it, they shouldn't be being forced into it in any way. Well, how do you measure that? I mean, one way you measure how voluntary people's consent is by looking at how many people drop out of a trial over time. This is what ethicists do when they look at, voluntariness of consent, is they say, well, look, 15, 20, 30% of the people are dropping out of this trial. Well, that's a good indication that they, in fact, were consenting voluntarily, because, of course, they've just withdrawn their voluntary consent. So they knew that it was voluntary then. They just left the trial. And here in the States, 15 to 45 to even more percent dropout rate is not considered abnormal. That's sort of the general range. Well, in a lot of these developing countries, there's very, very low dropout rates. In fact, sometimes it's, 99% of the people who are approached actually stay in the trial. And this is what investigators who are doing trials there say. We retain 99.5% of the people who come into our trials, or they say nobody ever refuses us. For example, the National Bioethics Advisory Committee did a survey of investigators who are active in developing countries, and 45% of those people said, when they approach someone to be in their trial, they never get any refusals. So that is one indication that people aren't consenting voluntarily. But that's obviously just sort of it's not an ironclad kind of evidence of it. There's also been studies. Medical anthropologists have gone into trials in developing countries. They're already ongoing. So people have already signed up or signed on the dotted line, informed consent, yes. And then these people come in and they just give them a simple quiz with some questions. Well, in those studies, it's really fascinating, because 80% of people in a trial in South Africa, for example, said on that, in that questionnaire, that they were not aware that they were free to leave the trial. So they felt that if they left the trial, they wouldn't get any care. So, which is essentially a coercive situation. So the choices they saw it was be experimented on or be deprived of health care. That's not the choice we're supposed to be giving. That is a violation of the voluntary consent principle, in my opinion.
Couldn't, like in a kind of a simplistic way, couldn't somebody argue that in places where medicine is really scarce, that having it made available, even if it's risky, would be better than not having it at all? Well, how would you respond to that argument?
That's exactly what the people who are doing these trials say. Like, well, at least we're giving them something. You know, it's better than what they have. What they have is nothing. So, you know, at least we're giving them something. And I think our responsibilities are bigger than that. That's not what we're supposed to be doing. That is a violation of our ethical responsibilities according to the research ethic code that are already in our laws, you know, and that 34 countries around the world are signatories to. We're not supposed to be exploiting people that way. We're supposed to be giving them the best current methods. Everyone in a trial is supposed to be getting the best current methods. They're also supposed to be having a reasonable likelihood of enjoying the benefits of the research if they're taking on the risks. So, you know, this simple sort of exploitation, which is the sort of argument people would give of, well, at least, you know, when we send the low-wage worker, low-wage factory work abroad, right? Well, it's better than what they had. They had nothing. Now at least they have a job that pays, you know, $2 a month or whatever. And in the world of business, that's not illegal. It might be, you know, some people might frown upon it. I would take issue with that because I think it is exploitative, but it's not against the law. It's not against the rules. In fact, in a lot of ways, that's considered good business. Well, that's not true in medical research. In medical research, we're supposed to do much more than that. We're supposed to ensure that people are actually, you know, if they're taking on the risk, that they have a likelihood of joining the benefits, and they're supposed to be doing it voluntarily. They're not supposed to be like up against a rock in a hard place when they're choosing it. That's not the way we're supposed to be doing medical research. And if we want to change the codes, that's fine. Let's go through the channels, have the public debate, and change the codes. But that is what the research codes say now. And I think it has a lot of validity because it's recognizing that being a subject in a medical trial is different than doing low-wage factory work. It's turning your body into matter, and that, you know, that has different implications.
Mm-hmm. And I also wonder if other issues play into the whole equation or this equation, such as the power differences and who has the patterns and who sets the prices.
Absolutely. I think that's a really good point because when I bring up the issue of, look, there's a real lack of oversight in a lot of these trials in developing countries because the people who are supposed to oversee the trials have a huge conflict of interest because they want the funding stream so badly. You know, a lot of these are underfinanced places, public hospitals, clinics. They don't have enough tools. They don't have enough clinicians. They don't have enough time. They don't have enough money. You know, if a drug company is going to come and give them money to do something, then, you know, that's a huge, there's a huge bonus for them. So they have a lot of the people on those committees have a big conflict of interest. And I bring that up in my book, and I talk to a lot of people at FDA about this, and they essentially say, look, just because people are poor doesn't mean they can't give informed consent. So, yes, maybe the oversight isn't great, but, like, you know, people can always drop out. It's their choice. You know, they can always come in and out and whatever. And, I mean, I think that's absolutely true. Like, you know, these concepts aren't incomprehensible, you know. I mean, there might be alien concepts, but they're not incomprehensible. If you put enough energy in, you can inform someone about an experiment, even if it's complicated. But the fact is there is a huge dichotomy between the power of the different actors involved, where here, you know, there's lots of problems with patients not feeling empowered in clinics and stuff, but at the same time, you know, people seek out second opinions. Many people do have health insurance. We even have a concept of patient rights. We have clinicians who are trained in ethics. I mean, in medical schools and in other training situations, they're trained in ethics. We have a code of ethics that's part of our American Medical Association, for example. So the licensing, you know, requires you to abide by ethical codes. Well, none of that is true in a country such as India. You know, only 1% of patients have health insurance. So everyone's paying up front for their care. And the people who are actually signing on to clinical trials are often the very poorest people, because they're the ones who really have no choice and are willing to give up the doctor's opinion for the randomizing computer which decides your care in a clinical trial. And these people really live in a world apart from the doctors who are making these decisions for them. And I think the doctors then have a huge amounts of power over them. And that might be okay, even if we compensate for that, you know. But if we're just going to say, oh, look, this patient can decide, he can come or go as he pleases, and we're not recognizing what the power differential is, I think that is, you know, that is a troublesome situation.
Mm-hmm. I'm speaking with Sonja Shah about her book, The Body Hunters, Testing New Drugs on the World's Poorest Patients. And she will be reading from this book at 7:30 tonight. She's going to rush out of here to go to Powell's book on Burnside, 1005 West Burnside at 7:30. If you want to catch her there, the book is hot off the press and it will be available there. How did you write this book? How did you conduct the research for it?
A lot of it was doing a lot of background research, actually, documentary research on the diseases and drugs that I look at in more detail in the book. Because the challenging thing about writing about this topic is you can't really make generalizations. Of course, I have to get on these radio shows and make generalizations, but in fact, each trial is different, and each trial you have to look at what is the drug, what do people know about the drug, what do people know about the disease. You know, it really varies from situation to situation. So a lot of the research for the book was just doing that, learning about these different diseases and learning about the drugs that had been developed and learning about what scientists knew at the time when they did the trials. So a lot of it was that kind of documentary research. And then I did my reporting, you know, in South Africa and India, and talk to a lot of people as well. And putting it together was, another big challenge, just to keep it's complicated to kind of hold a reader's hand through all of the sort of science and medicine of it, so you can get to, well, what are the human rights implications, you know, because you have to sort of get all that stuff under your belt before you can really make a decision on that.
And you come from a family of medical folks, right? So, like, do you have dinner table conversations about this?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, that was a big, a huge help. I mean, I think for any journalist, if you have enough sources who, you know, you can ask really dumb questions to, then you can kind of get a lot more done. So, definitely. I grew up in a medical family. My parents actually were trained in India. And so going and doing the reporting there was made easier by having a lot of context already in medical circles in that country. My husband's a scientist, and, you know, so I sort of have enough science people around me that I was able to draw on to, you know, clarify a lot of the stuff. I mean, of course, I use sort of expert sources throughout the book, but you need those people you can ask the really stupid questions to.
And how is the book received in those circles, people who deal with science and medicine, who, you know, have things to gain and to lose, maybe?
It's interesting. It's been, I've had a lot of support from places I didn't think I would. For example, the FDA invited me to speak at the agency, which was pretty amazing. I've been invited to speak at, hospitals that do clinical trials in New York, for example. I've been invited to speak for ethics departments at medical schools, for example, Georgetown. So that's been really good. But on the other hand, I think for a lot of people, and I've also been approached by lots of people in the drug industry, who are saying, oh, thank you for writing this book and telling the truth. Of course, these are all people who are sort of getting laid off because their company's getting bought out by someone else or something. So they kind of have a little bit of sour grapes. But on the other hand, I think there is this idea that these are things you're not supposed to talk about. You know, medical research is so, so, so important. You can't talk about Tuskegee. You can't talk about Nuremberg. You can't impugn the people who are doing this important work by bringing up all of this, like, dirty laundry. So there is that sort of sense of, oh, this is too sensationalistic. How can you talk about Tuskegee syphilis study in the same book as you're talking about people who are doing AIDS research? You know, and I'm not saying people doing AIDS research are like Tuskegee, you know, anything similar, but I think all of that stuff, the so-called dirty laundry, is part of our history we need to reclaim, and we need to look at more seriously and judge where has that brought us. You know, I mean, this is all those transgressions occurred in the time when we did not have legal protections for research subjects, right, in this country, all of those major transgressions. Well, now we're taking all these trials to places that don't have any legal protections for research subjects. You know, so what are we expecting to happen out of that? You know, I mean, I think sort of whitewashing it and saying, look, medical research is very important. We shouldn't talk about all these dirty things. You know, I think that is a troubling, mm-hmm. a troubling way to look at it.
And again, Sonia Shah, about her book, The Body Hunters, which you can hear her in person at 7:30 at Powell's on Burnside. And you can also hear her tomorrow speaking about oil. And we'll talk about that conference a little more later. So this is the second book you wrote yourself. What is your next project?
And my next book is going to be about malaria. I just started a book doing research for the past year. And hopefully it'll be out 2008, 2009.
Mm. Malaria worldwide?
Yeah, sort of looking at this question of why malaria is still with us in such a big way. I mean, malaria takes about 3 million lives every year, 500 million cases a year. Most infectious diseases sort of reach a peak after 100 years and then sort of reach an accommodation with, you know, the human population after another 100 years. So, you know, cholera and all the rest of it, we sort of like had plague, we had big outbursts of it, and then we sort of accommodated them in some ways. Of course, our drugs and vaccines helped, but they usually came sort of after the fact, you know, after that major accommodations had been done. Well, malaria we've had since we evolved from apes. So for thousands and thousands and thousands of years, and we know how to prevent it. We know how to cure it. Why do we still have 500 million cases a year? You know, I mean, this is sort of, to me, this is a burning question. I mean, this gets to the heart of what's really going on with us in terms of our, you know, how are we distributing the goods, you know, the goods of health, the goods of wealth. I think malaria is a big part of that issue.
And you do have a website for people who want to find out more about you and your writings.
I do. It's very simple, www.soniashah.com.
So this was Sonia Shah, and if you have time, check her out at Powell's tonight at 7:30 or tomorrow at the Conference on Oil, which we will dedicate the second half of our program to. You're listening to KBOO 90.7 FM, and this is Bread and Roses, Women's News and Public Affairs. Thank you so much for coming in. I know you've just got to town, you're dead tired, and you have more to do tonight even. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Hello again. You're still listening to KBO 90.7 FM to Bread and Roses Women's News and Public Affairs. And I just let Sonia show go to Powell's, where she will be at 7:30 to talk about her book, The Body Hunters, Testing New Drugs on the World's Poorest Patients, at the Powell's on Burnside. But she also will be the keynote speaker and a panelist at a conference tomorrow, which is the topic for the second part of our show. The conference is called Behind Oil, and hopefully I have Angela with me now. Angela Crowley-Koch, are you there?
I'm here. Thanks for having me.
Thank you for coming on the air. This Angela Crowley-Koch is the director of Oregon Physicians for Social Responsibility. Can you tell us a little bit about the conference tomorrow?
Yes. First of all, it's called Beyond Oil because we're working to move to a culture and an economy and a system beyond our use of oil that Sonia Shaw was talking about. We are very much dependent on oil as a society and a culture and our economy. And like Sonia talked about, there are many negative consequences of our dependence on oil, especially foreign oil. And these range from global warming to the impending peak oil crisis. And of course, there's the connections between our energy policies and our foreign policies. And Physicians for Social Responsibility has been very involved in the anti-Iraq war movement and the peace movement and other wars that we've participated in as a country. And we really see the connection between our energy policies and our foreign policies. Beyond the slogan, no blood for oil, there are definitely resource wars going on over oil and who will get the last remaining drops. So in terms of future foreign conflict, oil is really going to be a central player. And so if we want to have a peaceful future, it's very important to move beyond oil. So tomorrow, that's one of the topics we'll be discussing. There's six workshops. The conference is it's from 9 a.m. until 4:30 p.m. It's at the Multicultural Center at Portland State University, which is room 228 in Smith Memorial Student Union. And after Sonia Shaw's keynote talk, there will be a set of three workshops. The first three are Using the Oil and War Connection to Promote Peace. The panelists on that workshop are Teresa Keene, who's a nurse practitioner and on the board of Oregon Physicians for Social Responsibility, Gary Langenwalter, who's the co-chair of the Oregon Interfaith Global Warming Campaign, and Sonia Shaw, who you just heard. And we'll be talking, that workshop will be talking more about what I just discussed. How can the peace movement use this connection of oil and war to promote peace and to really have the general public understand that these things are related, and most Oregonians actually want to reduce our dependence on foreign oil. And that's very connected to wanting a peaceful foreign policy and removing ourselves from the Middle East and the conflicts we get into in that region. So I think at the peace movement, we could do a lot better at connecting these issues and using that connection to promote peace. So that's the first workshop.
Okay.
And all this information, by the way, is on our website, which is www.oregonpsr.org.
And the other workshops.
So the other workshops, the next one is called Implications of Peak Oil for Portland and for Oregon. And the speakers on that will be Chris Caruso, who is a local architect, and she's also a member of the City of Portland's Peak Oil Task Force. Jeremy O'Leary, who is a co-chair of the local nonprofit Portland Peak Oil, and Charlie Stevens, who is a former employee at the Oregon Department of Energy. Mm-hmm. And Sonia touched on peak oil just a little bit. This workshop will explore the implications of peak oil.
Can you just, like, maybe in one sense explain what that term means. It's thrown around a lot, and I'm not sure everybody really has a grasp on what it means.
Well, geologically, there's a limited supply of oil in the world. And what happens, the production of oil looks like a bell chart. Right in the beginning, when you first discover oil, you can extract oil very quickly and easily. So that curve slopes upward pretty quickly. And then eventually you get to a peak of where the oil, we've taken enough oil out of a particular oil field that it starts becoming a little harder to extract. It's farther underneath the ground. Instead of it just gushing out of the ground, it's now we have to pump it out. It's getting more difficult. And as we move to the right of that peak, extraction becomes more and more difficult and starts to move down on that bell curve. Now, as global oil production is reaching its peak, the U.S. has already peaked in our oil production in 1971 that we peaked. So we're now on that down, the decline of our nationwide oil resources. So globally, when we peak, we'll be able to extract less and less and less, but the demand is going up and up and up in sort of a linear upward line, especially with all the development in China and India, as well as every place really around the world is demanding more oil. So in that time period when demand is still increasing and the production starts decreasing, costs are going to dramatically increase, and that will affect every aspect of our life. It will affect the economy. Some businesses will have trouble shipping their product to market. They'll have to cut costs. If some businesses will grow, like biofuels or other renewable energy, but some businesses will not be able to, they're so dependent on oil as a part of their business, they won't be able to continue. Oil is also used, oil and natural gas, which will also peak, are heavily used in our food production and modern agricultural, industrial agriculture systems in this country and around the world. And that will look very different after peak oil than it does today. Oil, look around the room that you're in. You can't look at, I bet few people will be able to look around the room and not find a product that has oil in it. So this very expensive oil is really going to affect our lives and change our lives. And because of this, the city of Portland has passed a resolution to form a peak oil task force to look at all these aspects. How will peak oil impact Portland, and what can the city do about it? I'm a member of that task force, and Chris Caruso, who will be on the panel, is as well. That report will be coming out in early January for public comment and will be released to the City Council in late January.
Just announce again who we are for people who tune in later.
My name's Angela Crowley-Cook. I'm the Executive Director of the Oregon Chapter of Physicians for Social Responsibility.
And we're talking about a conference that will take place tomorrow, and we'll announce the details again later in a second.
That's right. The conference is called Beyond Oil, tomorrow at PSU.
Okay. So you were going on to some other workshops, I believe.
Yeah. So the next workshop is called Renewable Energy and Efficiency. And the panelists are State Representative Jackie Dingfelder, who represents the Hollywood District in Portland. And then Mark Kendall, works for the Oregon Department of Energy. And John Pearson, who is a physician and a board member of Physicians for Social Responsibility. Excuse me, I have to take a cough drop here.
It's that season.
Yes. So this workshop will be talking about some of the opportunities that we have in renewable energy and efficiency. In the last legislative session, Representative Dingfelder helped pass a bill about efficiencies and making small appliances more efficient. While that may seem like a small thing, it's actually a huge savings for us in energy and financially. Mark Kendall with the Department of Energy will talk about other renewable energy projects that Oregon is participating in right now. And Dr. Pearson will talk about nuclear power and how we believe that's not the best solution. Excuse me, I'm losing my voice.
Better save some for tomorrow, too.
Right. The next workshop is called Economic Opportunities. The speakers are Barbara Bird with the AFL-CIO, Portland City Commissioner Randy Leonard, and Sally Schillinger-Krauss from the Oregon Environmental Council. And this workshop will mostly focus on biodiesel and the opportunities that it presents for Portland and for Oregon, and also other renewable energies and what kind of fair and new jobs that can be created that will have a good promise for working families and for creating more jobs with a living wage in Oregon. The next workshop is called Creating a Movement, Education and Advocacy. And the speakers will be Lisa Adato with the Oregon Business Association, Jeremiah Bowman with Oregon State Public Interest Research Group, and Terry Graham with Code Pink Portland. And this workshop will focus on how will Oregon get there to actually being beyond oil. So the workshop will focus on different efforts that are currently underway in terms of education and advocacy movements, and then how people can be involved. The final workshop is called Global Warming in Oregon. The speakers are Dr. William Barnes with the University of Portland, Eric Miller with the Global Warming Action Network, and Ronald Mitchell with the University of Oregon. Global warming will affect Oregon in very specific ways, especially our agriculture, our economy, our oceans, wildlife, and health. And so these speakers will review all the different kinds of impacts that might happen in Oregon, and then also what we can do personally to reduce global warming pollution. After the conference, we intended the conference to be not just some place where you just come and then learn all day and then go home and continue your life, but rather something where you go to the conference and take part in strategizing about how are we going to move beyond oil in my community and in my neighborhood. What can I personally do in my own home, in my own life, but also what can I do to be part of a larger movement in creating new jobs for a peak oil future, or to participate in legislative efforts to reduce global warming pollution and other ideas. So at the end of the conference, we'll have a strategizing action planning time where everyone can talk about how we will actually get there. And then after the conference, there'll be a reception with Sonia Shaw, also with Representative Jackie Dingfelder, and with Metro Councilor Rex Burkholder. And so people will have a chance to actually sit down with Sonia Shaw and Representative Dingfelder and talk about these issues, and also about Sonia's second book, The Body Hunters, Testing New Drugs on the World's Poorest Patients. That reception is in the same location, the Multicultural Center, which is room 228 in Smith Union at Portland State University. The reception's from 5 to 7. And tickets are $50 per person or $25 for students, and everything benefits the Oregon chapter of Physicians for Social Responsibility.
And that fee is for the reception. The conference itself is free, right?
That's right.
Yeah. So it's an all-day conference. It sounds like a great opportunity to get lots of different kinds of information. And it is tomorrow at Portland State Multicultural Center from 9 till 4:30 p.m. This is organized by Physicians for Social Responsibility. This may, again, seem like a simplistic question, but why would physicians care about oil?
It's a great question.
She says as she's choking away on the other end. Oh, boy.
Oh, sorry about that. Well, Physicians for Social Responsibility was a group formed by physicians back in the 60s, and they were concerned about nuclear testing and the effects it was having on the populations and on our soldiers who were being exposed to these tests. So their work in the 60s actually led to the ban of atmospheric nuclear testing. So that's how Physicians for Social Responsibility started, that physicians play a unique role in advocacy because they come to it from the health perspective and are able to really call attention to public health matters that surround key issues like global warming, like nuclear weapons. Physicians are very concerned about global warming. There's a number of serious health impacts from global warming. First of all, as temperatures rise, air pollution increases. That's just a fact of chemistry. And as air pollution increases, of course, asthma increases. Allergies to just your regular old allergies to pollen and other things increases. Of course, heat-related diseases increase. And vector diseases, things that are carried by mosquitoes like malaria and West Nile virus, that will also increase because as temperatures rise, the mosquitoes can live longer and they can move farther north and live for longer seasons in Portland. We don't have too many mosquitoes here, but that will change as global warming takes hold. So this has a direct impact on public health, and physicians are very concerned. PSR is also concerned about the connections between our energy policy and our foreign policy. As we know from the large number of deaths in with this latest Iraq war, the Lancet, which is a British medical journal, just did a study that said over 600,000 Iraqis have died. I mean, that's astounding just from this small time period. And so physicians have a direct interest in making sure that, you know, this huge number of citizens are not killed in these extraneous wars. And if we look at it from a preventative standpoint, if we reduce our demand for oil, especially foreign oil from the Middle East, we can take one step further towards preventing these foreign conflicts, especially, well, not only in the Middle East, but also in places like Nigeria. We've always been involved politically in South America as well. There's an interesting correlation between oil-producing countries and U.S. foreign involvement. So for all of these reasons, physicians and health professionals are very concerned about moving beyond oil. We'd like to facilitate that as much as possible.
And this may all sound very overwhelming and hopeless. One of the things that impresses me about that conference tomorrow is that it has strong local ties to look at what we can do locally to kind of start addressing these
That's
issues.
That's right. It's very overwhelming and depressing if you just kind of sit down and learn all about it. But there are so many things we can do and things that have already started happening. The Peak Oil Task Force is a great, you know, example of this that has just started in Portland. It's the first one in the country. We're the first city to really, you know, assign a task force and look at all the ways that peak oil will be affecting our city and our region. There's also all these new biofuel developments, the renewable energy, and, I mean, the peace movement itself has been so strong in the past 3 years and had so many people come out on the streets to protest the Iraq war that I think people really see the connections among all of this. And right after Hurricane Katrina, I think that the visibility of global warming increased dramatically, which I think will really help us to get to a place where we can significantly reduce global warming pollution. So there's lots of solutions and lots of things people can do to get involved and to help us move beyond oil.
You want to give us the website again for the conference tomorrow?
Yes, it's www.OregonPSR, Physicians for Social Responsibility, .org. And the conference, again, is at from 9:30 to 4:30 in Smith Memorial Union, the Multicultural Center, which is room 228 at Portland State.
Anything else you would like to know us about that conference?
Well, don't forget about the reception afterwards. I love personally having a chance to sit down with local policymakers and sort of pick their brain about what they think the solutions are for Oregon and for Metro. You'll have a chance to talk with Representative Jackie Dinkfelder and Metro Councilor Rex Burkholder, two people that are very concerned about global warming and about renewable energy and different transportation options that we have to reduce our global warming pollution. So that'll be a great opportunity as well. That's from 5 to 7 in the same location, the Multicultural Center.
Okay. So we're towards the end of the show. Thank you so much for coming on and talking about this conference.
Thanks so much for having me.
Yeah, thank you for taking the time. And I hope to see you tomorrow, and hopefully you still have some voice.
Thank you. I hope so, too.
This was Bread and Roses on KBO 90.7 FM, and I will be heading over to Powell's to catch Sonia Shaw there, but you can also see her tomorrow at PSU at the all-day conference put on by Physicians for Social Responsibility entitled Beyond Oil. Thank you so much for listening, and stay tuned next Friday for Bread and Roses, KBOO's Women's News and Public Affairs Collective. Thank you very much. Good evening.
In the sky, rebel cold, rebel cold, huddled in the cellar's underground. They're tapping out a card to bring you down.